this is the place where everything that I am naturally is left outside the door. I don't know what the tide is going to bring. Things that I think I have control of, I come here and realize that I don't. Things that I lived in fear of are actually much better than they seem. Over 9 years, we built partnerships. Me and Kavita, Kavita and Anil, me and Anil, me and Jit. We battled things together as partners as well. Great partnerships, suddenly you realize the other person doesn't like this version of you. Partnerships where you're like, hey, this is not a good phase for us, suddenly you achieve a win, which was unexpected. It is the most bizarre experience where I still show up the next day because it is going to be a roller coaster.
Hi, wherever you're listening to us, I hope you're doing well. Welcome to Startup Fridays, conversations with accomplished entrepreneurs and VC investors. I'm Hari Arakli, and today I bring you part two of a conversation with Kavita Shenoy and Anand Gopal on their 10-year entrepreneurial roller coaster building Vairo, an ad tech SaaS company in Bengaluru. In today's episode, they talk about how the $750 billion ad landscape is changing, their hopes for Vairo's future, how building their own company has been life-changing, and why it has them coming back for more every day. One thing I meant to ask at the outset and I forgot, how did you all hit upon the name Vairo? Is there any significance to that?
Vairo comes from the word, a French word, voir, which means to see. And we kind of took a spin on that word because we wanted it to sound a little easier to pronounce. But in full disclosure, our name has been kind of called whatever people remember it as. The reason why we named it, you know, with this whole to see meaning was because we were very intent on making sure that we were able to visualize as well as make accessible underlying computed data from revenue across the monetization workflow, which is the main problem that we actually set out to solve, right? Making sure that we were connecting everybody on the monetization workflow for ads and also surfacing to them information that was pertinent to their job role.
Can you briefly step back and describe the ad pie today as you see it? I remember in one of your interviews last year, you spoke about how it's a $1 trillion market today. Can you break that down for us? TV, OTT, broad, you know, publishing, I mean, traditional publishing, and just to give us a sense of which areas are really growing, which are promising, which are on the sort of downturn or whatever.
Sure, I can start that off and you can add through it. So the way the pie is currently set up is that 70% of it is with the walled gardens, right? In terms of advertising. If you're looking at the business model of how does content make money, it is advertising and then subscriptions. Advertising is definitely at the forefront. While subscriptions are growing, it will find, you know, its own level because of purchasing power and the ability to support several subscriptions at the same time. And advertising being a good way to give things for free, and people always love things that are free, right? If in the pecking order, it's advertising, subscription, in terms of and transactional video on demand, which are the three types of models in which the industry, content industry, makes money. From a content perspective, the broadcast space is in a migratory phase right now, right? While studios and production of content and things like that are still firmly held with the legacy studio producers, the pockets to be able to create this kind of content, because content creation is very expensive, still lies with the technology companies, which is why you see them kind of dabbling around in creating of content because of the fact that they're able to, not because it's strategically important to them. The TV industry, from an appointment viewing perspective, in my opinion, is dead, unless it's a live event, right? Having a central large screen in your house is still going to stay. We are all going to still have, maybe several rooms will have several large focal points, several large screens, but then the form factor will remain from a device perspective, but the ability to have certain things released in a timely manner is declining, right? There is no particular reason why I would come back from work and watch a particular show unless it is a live match or a live sport that is being aired at that point in time. In the TV space, cable, set-top box delivery distribution is also going, right? OEMs are entering the distribution world with Samsung and Vizio and everybody else. And so this is again a migratory phase. People are going to wait out their contracts with other distributors to be able to put their content up into the CTV or connected TV space. Radio is flatlining and declining. Even though we see Spotify has become a lot more profitable now, music online is definitely increasing. But then radio in itself, terrestrial radio in itself is declining. Print, although we are not going to buy newspapers, they will still produce it to make sure that you are able to pick it up at an airport or somewhere where you're waiting, just to market it to you. But otherwise, print, I don't think publishing is going to decline, because we need content to be created, right? Or how much of you talk about AI, AI generated, you have to prompt it. It's all about what's happening now. AI is all about what it has already learned, right? But you need human beings to be able to create content about what's happening today and be able to inform users today about what's happening, right? So I think publishing from a form factor perspective will change. But the creation of content in itself will flourish, because there'll be a huge need for it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we see even in, you know, our publishing clients as well. It's more like, it's akin to, I know I'm taking a leap here, but it's akin to live streaming, right? It has to happen for it to be canned. I will want to read it. News and information is something that I will want to be able to consume. How it is consumed, to what frequency and things like that starts to become questionable. And the last part is movies and cinemas and releases will also see a massive decline because of the OTT platforms that are there. And the effort versus impact of going to a theater and spending so much money on a ticket and concessions, etc., is going to be relegated only to things that are massive entertainers like Oppenheimer or something that pierces the cultural zeitgeist and catches the attention of the generation like Barbie. But otherwise, or Rocky or Rani Ki Prem Kahani or something. That's something that's super hyped. But regular movie going will decline. And recently, have you gone and watched Taylor Swift's Era?
No.
My 12-year-old daughter took four of her friends and raged in a movie. Yeah, in a movie hall. Right? And I was like, this is... I thought it was a movie, but it was literally like a music show in a movie hall. So these things are going to change. Traditional way of looking at content and consuming content is going to change. But the last part is retail media. That is going to blow the top off the industry in general. It's going to suck in content as well. It is going to make sure that it's going to take a lot of advertising money away from your various networks, so much so that, you know, we are reading that Facebook and Google, etc., have applied for e-commerce licenses in Southeast Asian countries so that they are able to sell products, right? So that's going to become the new face of advertising, because that is the easiest way to drive money bottom of the funnel. So that's basically how I see the industry. TV dying, broadcast dying, everything internet enabled, TV as a box, and I mean as a screen, still kind of making sure that it's the focal point in the house. And content creation will definitely keep like have a central point.
So in this backdrop, currently, which are the areas where you're already strong, and in the coming quarters and next 2-4 years, what are your big priorities?
Fantastic. So I think, like Kavita has given you across the backdrop of this industry, there is one corner of it which is where we focus, which is large publishers who are managing direct relationships with advertisers, specifically on the publishing OTT and streaming side and on the e-commerce side. These are the two areas where we focus and where we have marquee customers. What we solve for them, like Kavita said, is giving them one of the various technologies that they use to run a compliant set of ads workflows, to create strong data pipes and an end-to-end data automation framework, and for them to be able to tap into that data to funnel their, fuel their own growth, right? So if you look at where we are focusing and sort of where the industry is going for the next like year or two, like Kavita said, there are two or three big underlying trends that are driving the industry. Ad spend in general across the industry is on a very strong growth path. So that is sort of the rocket fuel for all of us. It's about $750 billion this year, trending towards $1 trillion in global ad spend. About a third of that takes place in the US, but a significant chunk of that is growing faster in emerging markets, which is where we have a strong presence. The first trend that the industry is seeing is, like Kavita said, while traditional television is on the decline, I don't think digital is going to take over 100%. What's eventually going to happen is all media will become data-driven and addressable. And therefore, the move towards connected TV. So that is one. That shift towards data-driven spending across 100% of ad spend, as opposed to this current split between linear and digital. The second trend is retail media. I think what's driving that is our own consumption patterns, which have been accelerated through COVID. And therefore, a lot of advertisers are choosing to spend more of their time, attention and money at the bottom of the funnel. And therefore, we're seeing a lot more focus on retail media and therefore the ecosystem around it, which is also what's driving two of our big customers today. The third one is, of course, making sense of data and measurement. I think what's happened in this shift from linear to digital and digital growing faster than linear is the ability to have cross-media measurement solutions, the ability to honor privacy, the ability to make sure that you're able to respect local regulation while not flouting laws around how you use consumer data, and the ecosystem of products around this is also going to be huge. So for us, our investments over the next couple of years, or at least the next few quarters, are going to be as follows, right? One is for all of our customers to ensure that their compliance stack helps them while they scale the business. And this requires us to be SaaS, but also no code. This requires us to have an integration on a marketplace stack that keeps pace with their downstream products and their integrations. And the second one, plain and simple, and I know everyone says this and it's passe, is to help them make far more sense of data. Because we partner so deeply with these organizations, we have a relationship with them and their data that spans years. Every single dollar that they've sort of earned over the last 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years has gone through our pipes, is clean, is stashed, is ready for use. But to be able to layer those with the right algorithms, to uncover the right insights, to put that in front of the right teams or the right personnel at the right point in time so that they can make use of it and grow the business is a big area of focus for us. I know everyone says data-driven, everyone says AI and machine learning, but we're sitting on a very unique data set that can help these organizations.
You all have raised some money from this point onwards in the context of the investments you want to make. Will you need more money? Are you funding it with your own profits? Where are you at on that?
To be honest, in the nature of the global investment market today, we also read our environment very carefully. We've had the privilege of raising venture capital a couple of times, and we have very, very interesting investors on board who have very deep experiences across the software value chain. We're also a company that was bootstrapped for a long time before that, which means our fundamental DNA is driving ourselves to make revenue before we spend revenue, right? Will we ever need to raise capital? Depends on the market. If there is capital that can be raised on terms that are favorable to us, our current shareholders, our customers, it's always an option on the table. But outside of that, we're still running off of our own steam. We have customers to whom we drive a lot of value. We make revenue. We utilize that revenue to sort of keep us and keep our business fundamentals very strong as an organization. So I think as a B2B SaaS business, we are a revenue generating business, and that puts a very different spin on the kind of options on the table. Unlike large scale consumer businesses that are sort of tough on unit economics and are trying to drive profitability, we live in a world where should capital be available, we can use it to invest. But if not, we're always leaning on our own revenue and our own steam.
Yeah. So we're very close to being a sustainable, profitable business. We are still burning very low amount of money, but like he said, it's like it's by choice. I mean, we can pull the plug on that kind of a burn right now, but we need that little bit of burn to make sure that we are investing in certain aspects of the business that need to grow. But having said that, we also have a huge focus on strategic partners we are trying to leverage all the marketplaces with, you know, say AWS or SFDC marketplace and so on and so forth, for people to be able to find us. Because we also think that over the last decade or so, there has been a transition in the way buying processes are happening back to how it was 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, the CTO and the CIO would make decisions on what technology was bought. And then somewhere along the way, that thing frayed because people were able to swipe a card and buy SaaS products for themselves and their business units and be able to claim it. And it was so cheap that it was not even looked at. And after a point, organizations looked at the slew of, it was littered with all of these various products that they needed to consolidate. And now it's gone back to that era where decisions are made in a most centralized fashion. And they are leaning very heavily on marketplaces and their platforms to be able to recommend. They will ask AWS, they will attend AWS events, they will have people who are SFDC partners or their consultants to be able to recommend products. So we are also trying to look at being even from a growth perspective, looking at trying to tap into that ecosystem. Right? And so that's how we're looking at growing and sustaining ourselves as well in the long run.
So outside of salaries, is that sort of one of the biggest expenditures, what you all call customer acquisition costs?
Actually, outside of salaries, the other biggest cloud expenditure.
Cloud and acquisition.
Even in the layperson's SaaS understanding today, because it's trickled down to general business reporting as well, people always talk about things like ARR and net dollar retention and whatnot. So are those the kinds of metrics you all track for yourselves as well?
Yeah, we track ARR and MRR.
ARR, MRR, net retention. The same metrics.
Same metrics.
I mean, like I said, despite the fact that we are solving a problem for a newish industry, a very dynamic industry, we are governed by a board that has run businesses for the last 30, 40 years. And I think the business fundamentals that drive whether or not we are sustainable remain the same. So those metrics are, I think, the global standard for any SaaS business across the world. And one level below that is, of course, there's the same old metrics around revenue and cost and margins. And I think those are the metrics that drive our boardroom conversations as well.
In light of what you've said now, in the slightly more longer term, what is it that you all dream of for Wairo? What would you like it to be 5 years from now?
So we're the kind of business that will actually... From a growth perspective, be a great addition to an existing stack, right? And that is something that we are kind of now in the market looking for, where we can go place ourselves with, like a strategic partnership, basically, because our ambitions are that these kinds of problems will scale in outside the country as well. So we are focused on India. We have a South African customer. We have some presence outside the country. But Middle East, Southeast Asia, the US, UK, are all and Australia are places that we are looking to grow. And growth on the back of just having this one flagship product of ours requires a lot more effort rather than if we had to complete somebody else's stack. So that's what the ambition over the next 2 to 3 years is, to make sure that we actually land ourselves with a formidable strategic partnership with an external company, or a company that actually has ambitions to go out of the country, so that we can travel along with them.
I'll give you another perspective also in addition to that. We've been exposed, and I think the early sort of star experience was serendipitous, because they were, to have your first customer be a market leader, I think is rare.
Yeah.
And we don't take for granted that we were able to sort of get that exposure. But I think over now 9 years, we've been exposed at scale to all the internal problems of what it takes to manage data in a compliant fashion while scaling an ads business. While across the industry, the trend is eventually a majority of this $1 trillion will be data driven and move towards digital. The sort of fear in the industry is that linear had a standard. There were industry bodies, there were rating points, there were rating agencies. Digital is a very Wild West scenario. While there is a lot more data to play with, the fear that there is no standard could result in mayhem, so to speak, at an industry level. So one of our ambitions is to be that standard. We've been exposed to the length and breadth of how to manage data in a compliant fashion. Our product gets audited every year. Our customers get audited every year. And the data that flows through our pipes has been the cleanest and has also fueled growth for them. So one of our ambitions is through our platform, through our product, through strategic partnerships, to be able to be that standard for the industry that is increasingly becoming digital. And that's what we see as a lasting industry impact.
The other interesting thing that we have that works for us is the whole build in India and go global, right? Yes. The kind of scale that we've seen with IPL, the kind of monetization methods our customers have sort of pulled out of the hat and we've supported, I don't think the rest of the world has ever been this scrappy, this innovative,
yeah,
this open, and scaled to this level. Like recently, they had like 5.9 crore concurrency on the IPL match, on the World Cup match, right? I don't think that kind of scale is there even with the Super Bowl. And so while our supply for ad inventory far outstrips the demand in India because of where we are and the kind of, yeah, purchasing power, GDP, etc. that we have, there is no other place in the world that you can actually build for scale and take it globally, right? So we have great engineering talent and we're also cost effective. So that's where we are trying to leverage this whole space, because for ad tech, especially for the ad space, if you want to go global, you need to make sure that you're able to scale. And there's no other better place to experiment with scale than in India.
Yeah. I think you mentioned early in our conversation that ad tech is often referred to as a complicated space, right? What we've seen is that while that's true of any industry, including ad tech, it's also a lot that can just be explained by first principles. Yes, there are mountains of data that flow through our customers and therefore our platform. And we help them leverage it, keep it clean, and focus on scale and not at odds with each other. Growth at all costs need not be at the cost of compliance, need not be at the cost of sort of unclean data. And the first principles approach is always the same. For an ad to be shown, someone has to put it there. For someone to put it there, someone should have sold it. For someone to have sold it, someone should have bought it. And there are multiple channels you can use to buy ads today. And you can buy ads on different currencies, on different metrics. And that creates an sort of n-dimensional problem. But by keeping these pipes clean, you give these customers or our publishers the ability to innovate freely without worrying that they are going to sort of step off the tracks. The industry is going to come closer together. Buyers and sellers, advertisers and publishers, and all the intermediate technologies are going to use technologies such as blockchain to create a more transparent data stack. And what we are doing is also helping our customers be future-proof, because everything inside their houses is clean, is automated, is ready for use, is ready for exposure. So I think, like I said, the one mission for us, thinking long term, is to be able to set the standard for an industry that desperately requires it. The second one is culture. I think this is one of the first things Kavita said to me when day one, I still remember it was a Monday when we started the company, is if we don't focus on culture, it will go in a direction of its own. And we have always ensured that, you know, we give our people a space where it's fair, it's safe, you can think freely, you can be creative, you can innovate, you can be brave. And I think to this day, I mean, our earliest employees are still with us. And for me, that's a testament to the fact that we've created an environment that's challenging. It's also new. Most of our, I think other than Kavita, nobody here has come from this industry. Everyone here has walked into an industry that they were only a consumer of before they joined this company.
Yeah, and it kind of became our mission to educate everybody, to tell them that, yeah, it's not as complicated as you think. And like every industry, it has its jargon, its complicated history. But the thing is that we interact with it on a daily basis. And it's very deeply ingrained into the way we make decisions as well, implicitly, yeah, implicitly as well as explicitly, right? So, yeah, so we try and make people as obsessed about this space as we are, and we've been successful in it.
Yes.
So everybody thinks of, yeah, the business very differently.
Multiple times, very frequently within our founder rooms, within our boardrooms, we address the topic of, you know, we focusing on culture? Are we ensuring that as we tackle new problems, as we bring in new customers, as we bring in new talent into this company, we're moving our culture in a very positive direction? And that's something that's very close to our heart. And like I said, the day we started the company, it's one of the first things that Kavita had sort of put on the table, is let's create a culture that we want to be a part of ourselves.
How many people in your team today?
34.
Fair enough. I mean, yeah, I think in India, people are used to services companies, so they're always asking this question about how many people.
Yeah, I know. We want to keep it lean and mean.
Product space, it's less.
We actually ballooned up to like 51 during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it was just too much for us. It was just too much. And we were like, you know, we don't want to do this kind of an organization. Yeah. Because then there are, every time you do something, something's got to give, right? You found it.
But 34 people who live and breathe.
Yeah.
Advertising, monetization and content.
So I did want to come back to what I said I will come back to, which is to ask you a bit more about your own personal entrepreneurial journey and how you see it. So having a great idea and actually taking the plunge are two different things, right? So, and you're among the few, even today, even in today's India where we have, I don't know, 10, 15,000, what is the last count of startups registered on DPID or whatever. Still, it's a small number. And one could say Indians have always been very entrepreneurial in a jugaad sense because of sheer need for survival. This kind of giving up a great corporate job where you are actually doing very well, both of you in, you know, two very well-known companies. What kind of compelled you to want to take that plunge and give up that comfort zone and take the risk of building a startup?
I think it was hubris in in retrospect. And there were some really hard knocks along the way. I would peg it down to that. For me, at least. I know that I bullied Anand into coming on board. But see, we also come from a very privileged space, right? And there were so many times that we were like, okay, if this doesn't work out, we can always find our ways back to our jobs. And 10 years later, we're like, there's no job that's going to take us back. And we're not going to get this kind of... There are a lot of good things about having your own organization and a startup. The freedom to think, the freedom to ideate, build, take it to market is the independence is just liberating and so rare, right? I don't know whether I would survive in an organization, but never say never because organizations today have changed themselves, right? Yeah. It's no longer where we left off 10 years ago. But I think from an entrepreneurial journey perspective, the fact that we took that first step, I would think that it was the environment that encouraged us. Back in 2014, startups were all the rage. It was something that you could do. You could just do it. You could be a part of the space. It wasn't something that was unattainable. Of course, there was the hubris to blame, and the ability to look at money differently. It was not. We were not trying to survive. We were trying to thrive. And I think that was something that we tried to break out of.
To your earlier question, why the plunge and the journey? One is, why do you start it and why do you take the plunge? But there's another side of it, which is, why do you still show up every day?
Yeah, that is...
Right? Which is equally...
Agreed.
Equally, like, surreal. And I think that's what it boils down to, at least for me. Like, over 9 years, I've realized that entrepreneurship is a surreal experience only. Every day. By definition... pushes you out of your comfort zone and keeps you there. It never lets you go back into your comfort zone. And at some point, you get used to it. You just get used to it. I park my car down the road there and I walk like less than five minutes to the office. And I have to tell you, that walk every day is the most bizarre experience. I don't know what the tide is going to bring. As much as I would love to have control and I'm a very straight shooter, and if you knew me, you would know that about me. This is the place where everything that I am naturally is left outside the door. I don't know what the tide is going to bring. Things that I think I have control of, I come here and realize that I don't. Things that I lived in fear of are actually much better than they seem. Over 9 years, we built partnerships. Me and Kavita. Kavita and Anil. Me and Anil. Me and Jit. We battle things together as partners as well. Great partnership, suddenly you realize the other person doesn't like this version of you. Partnerships where you're like, hey, this is not a good phase for us. Suddenly you achieve a win, which was unexpected. It is the most bizarre experience where I still show up the next day because it is going to be a roller coaster. I think you jump on a roller coaster to jump on it, but you don't know when the left turn is going to be unexpected and when suddenly you're on a straight road.
Just got to enjoy that.
It's very strange, but you get used to the strangeness of it. And At some point, you leave behind a trail of great successes, tragic failures, but you just love the experience. I think that's what it boils down
to. And I also think these kind of conversations help us look back on it. Because half the time, like I said, we are just reacting, right? And then there is a need at some point to sit and consolidate and understand where you're at. But I feel like that's reflective of life in itself. So
we are still finding our feet as a nation of inventors, certainly. Maybe innovators, we are there. But as original inventors, what do you all do as founders in a larger network of entrepreneurs? And while you were talking about being entrepreneurs, I was thinking that in that context, if you crash and burn, it's not soul killing. You can own that as well.
Yeah.
But in a corporate organization, if you crash and burn, you lose your job. So very big difference, I think.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but you know, the grass is always, you know, on the other side. You're like, oh, you can go find another job or reestablish yourself. But yes, like you mentioned, I think this journey has definitely changed the way we look at how we want to bring up our children. What do we stress about? How do we encourage our own, our employees and our colleagues to think beyond the obvious? Mm. The reason why we were so successful initially was because we challenged the norm. We challenged the way things were done within a media organization. And we said it could be done better. It could be done faster. It could be done with, you don't have to do this job, right? This job is going to get you nowhere. Don't think of me as taking away your job with automation, but giving you a platform to raise yourself up above this manual work. But I think from your question, and it's a very deep question that you're asking, about how do you encourage and how do you look at inventing things and discovering new things and saying it's okay to crash and burn. I think we lean on very hard lessons. And I find that the people who are close to us are the ones that hold up that mirror. It's not us that actually have these moments of, have these epiphanies. It's like Anand's wife, Varsha, would say something about something they should have noticed some time ago and say, hey, but you guys got out of that. Or my husband, Sujith, would say, you know, this is nothing compared to what you guys did 2 years ago. And somebody else would hold up that mirror to give you that much needed time for reflection and lean in more towards that innovation that you're taking, because whenever you're inventing, innovating, discovering, it's not going to be a straight road. And I lean on that network very heavily. I don't believe that I have that, like, you know, that level of self-introspection, but I do open myself up to the circle of people that we have very closely around us who have really helped us along this way. Because if that wasn't there, I feel like we'd be open to the elements and then your own self-doubt will take over and you will genuinely give up. So I have not given up because of the three of my co-founders and the close circle of friends and family that have insulated me from myself and my self-doubt. So I think that is something that you learn to be able to provide it to somebody else. So you learn to be able to provide that insulation to your engineers, to your children, you know, to people who come to you for help, so on and so forth.
Yeah, I think the power of having multiple founders is you get everything in one. You get a support system. You also get people who ground you. I'll let you in on a conversation that we had in our founder group a while ago, right? Kavita is fundamentally a very optimistic person. And so one day, I think some conversation, I sat and I said, you have to tell me how. You break it down, I'm sure.
There's a framework. Anand wants to have a science behind everything. It has to be like a chemistry experiment.
But through those frameworks like this, right? Like she has a network that she leans on. But what it does for her is it offers perspective. I think to your point where you said, you know, a country like us, 1.5 billion people. For the longest time, I kept saying billion. Billion is long gone, right? It's 1.4, almost 1.5 now. To view it as black and white, I think is a gross injustice to how difficult it is for a country like ours. And that for me has also come from getting multiple perspectives. For every time we say the US is the gold standard for everything. I've lived in the US. I've gone to their DMV. It's an extraordinarily inefficient office. There are, I've lived in neighborhoods where it's fundamentally unsafe to go out after dark. Every country has problems. I was never a patriot, but after living and being back to India for the last few years, I'm also very proud of our country, right? In this global environment, we're growing 6.5%. Our inflation is under control. I think in a global environment that's fundamentally harsh, there's enough going on within India for domestic demand to drive this country forward. And I think in the same way, we also view our journey, and like you said, for our children, there's enough to be positive about, there's enough to whine about. But going back to that framework with Kavita, if we try and avoid looking at it black and white and realize that if you give it enough time, we're moving in the right direction. I think there's an old saying about, you know, boiling the ocean versus sort of raising the temperature. I think definitely raising the temperature as a country. And I think if you want to take that attitude and go back to what Kavita said, it's harder to choose to be optimistic. But once you make that choice, you can find ways to do it. And not in a sort of facetious way. I think
there's, just choose it. Yeah.
There's enough to do. It's also, I don't know, in some sense, it makes us grateful for what we have around us. Traveling abroad has always given me that perspective. Like I've been to very developed countries where I was scared to leave my hotel room in the evening. It makes me grateful for where we are and where we live. Doesn't take away from the inefficiencies around us that must be solved. But solving it for 1.5 billion people is very hard. But I think therefore the lesson for all of us is just stay in the arena. That's it.
I think, you know, I have two daughters, and one, and Anand has just had a baby boy. But, you know, from where I'm standing, I'm at the cusp of 10th grade exams. Both my daughters trying to choose what they want to do. And maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I was very stressed out about this eventual threshold that I'm going to be on, where I have to, like, push my children and they have to choose something that they can be, like, contributing members of society for. And now I'm just like, I don't care. I just want them to be well-adjusted, happy human beings that can just constantly learn, right? Because I don't care anymore, right? I don't care whether you pass or you fail, but I just want you to be able to pick yourself up and go to the next destination, because this is just one of them. That's something that I have learned along the way as well. It's very hard because, you know, when your child doesn't do very well or they do extremely well, you have to temper it as regular as just another day. It's very hard. Yes. But, I mean, we all try.
No, but it's so interesting. Like, even with Anil and Jitin, they're also parents. And all four of us are on a very different stage of our parental journeys as well. And we come here and fight these battles. But while she's worried about her daughter's 10th standard exam, I'm waiting for my son's teeth to come out. Because I'm worried. It hasn't come yet. Right? So everyone has so much going on behind their mind.
Yeah.
This question stayed in my head. You made a passing mention of, you know, coming from privilege.
Yes.
Wondering whether you want to take it further back. What's your earliest memory, you know, growing up and with what your parents were doing and what you were exposed to, which looking back, you feel had an influence on your career decisions or even how you work?
So I grew up in a decidedly middle-class family in Malleshwaram, and both my parents worked. My mum was a travel agent for nearly 43 years. My dad was in water treatment, and he built effluent treatment plants. Both are not very, they're not bank jobs, right? So I think they influenced me implicitly that there are other things to do in life rather than become a doctor, an engineer. Not like I was cut out for it any which ways, but that's something that gave me exposure. Both of us grew up in Malleshwaram, and serendipitously so.
Our parents were neighbors in 1981.
Yeah.
We figured out much later.
You know, we were exposed to things like dancing and singing and a whole bunch of classes that we all took just for granted. But it gave you the ability to hook on to things that you could explore about yourself. And that's a real privilege. I mean, today, of course, everything is so competitive. And if you're learning how to dance and you have to be like a YouTube star or have like 10 shows a day. But we used to just go for class because Tuesday and Thursday was dance class day. That's it, right? So you learn the rigor of just attending the class and making sure that you were in the spirit of dancing. We used to dance in all those temples around Malleshwaram and sing and whatever else. But the point is that we grew up in a safe environment that allowed us to explore whatever we wanted to, right? And My parents would come back home at 5 o'clock in the evening. I was left to my own devices and everybody trusted me, right? And I was not overly surveilled. I didn't have to like report back home. Nobody had me there. I didn't have a phone to tell people where I was. My mother would shout out of the window saying, "Where are you, Kavita?" And somebody would hear me and I would go running back home. But you developed a lot of consciousness of yourself. And I think that is a huge privilege for me because I knew I was very sure of what I, like today I'm much more unsure, but when I was in my 20s, I was super sure about what I wanted to do, right? But that was because of the background I came from and the kind of trust that was instilled in me and the sense of self that I was able to develop at a very early age. And I think that's speaking for most of my generation that grew up at that point in time. There was no doubt. I never got bullied online and I didn't think about how my face looked and put a filter on my face or my face. I didn't see it much because I was not in front of any reflective surface that much. So yeah. What about you?
Like I said, our families were neighbors, which means the general fabric was very similar. My mother worked for State Bank of India. My father worked for L&T. So very nuclear family growing up. But I think the one thing that's always imprinted and this is something that goes very against my nature. I'm not an adventurous person. Extremely. I'll overlook the finances of our company as a result of like that mindset, right?
Yeah, so we used to call our, up until we got professional accounting services, we used to call this sheet called the Munshi sheet.
Yeah.
And we used to sit and obsess over every single line. And Anand used to clutch this book and walk around saying, we are going to die tomorrow. Yeah. But it wasn't the case. But the point was that we were
No, but there's two things from my upbringing that have still had a big imprint on me. One is, of course, both my parents did not come from means and completely self-made, both of them. But I still remember, like, in the fourth grade, my father sat me down because I'm a sports lover. Play sports, I watch sports, I use sports analogies and irritate everybody around me.
Hey, you've spread it across the company. At least we now know all the sports analogies, if not playing the sport.
No, but for my father, someone who came from a not well-to-do background and made it in L&T in a job that he worked for like decades. When I was in fourth standard, he sat me down and he seriously said, "Do you want to have a career in sports?" And I'm like, reflect now, it seems very, it didn't belong. Similar to how he sat me down and said, "Why don't you be adventurous, go and sort of become an entrepreneur. Don't work a job and like be good at it. There's no fun in it." So it's completely different from what you'd expect. So that one learning from both him and my mother is you can expand your horizons. You can think very differently compared to what you are predisposed to thinking or what your background dictates you should sort of think. And that's exposure from I don't know what, from reading, from just thinking differently. I don't know what it is. And the second thing is to my parents have always helped everybody around them. Everybody, to a point where they may not have had the means to help, but they have helped. They have funded the education of maids' kids, the auto wala's kids, an orphanage near our house. And for me, that's something that I don't think I will ever live up to, but I try and do it everywhere around me. But it's something that I saw them do consistently, like without effort. Like, and for specific causes. For my father, it was always education because he was deprived of an education growing up. So to this day, if someone goes to him and says, "I need money for education," he will not ask a question. He will help them. But that fundamental DNA to say, always try and just help. Doesn't matter. If you have something, give it to somebody else. It'll help them. Those two things have always created an imprint on me.
Okay. The second question I wanted to ask you was, and to bring it back to Wairo today, or rather the Wairo journey, what comes to your mind in terms of something that was probably, looking back, was your worst low? And maybe you can contrast it with what was a great high.
I think running out of money was my biggest low, where I had to borrow money from a friend. And
when was this?
This was 2015, before we raised any money and things like
well
that.
Well before we raised
money. Yeah, well. Like a year into it. We needed to make sure that, because we had costs at that point, right? We had server costs and we had an employee. We had Ankit at that point, employee number one, who's still with us. And it's a small amount of money. 5 lakhs is not so much, but in the larger scheme of things, right? But at that time, it reduced me to tears because I was like, oh my God, we're mm-hmm. going to run. And it was not, we hadn't yet run out of money. We were going to run out of money thanks to this Munshi sheet. He had projected it saying that if we don't get in 5 lakhs, like in the next month and a half, we're going to be done for. And there was no way that we could take a loan or who would give us a loan at that point, right? And too late to raise money. One of my friends, our friends, Arjun, helped us out at that point. And we were so relieved. I cannot believe that was both my low point and my high point, I guess, to making sure that we were able to fill that gap. But it was a small amount of money. But like I said, everything is relative. That was my low point.
Yeah.
What was your low point?
Not a single low point. But one of the things that is deeply important to me is, I believe that the four of us as founders go into battle together, which frequently means disagreements. It means we are having polar opposite views that we must come together and fight. But periodically, there are times where we think so differently that we must resolve it. And for me, it aches me when sort of we're not on the same page, which I know is fundamentally opposed to how entrepreneurs should be. You're expected to fight it out. You're expected to embrace conflict. But it's just so hard when it happens. So a lot of my low points are tied to sort of us struggling to get through a phase, us sort of having very different opinions on something. And I know that it sounds stupid. It's not going to be peachy, right? We're not always going to be like sort of skipping to the next phase. But for me, that transition is always the hardest for me. And so there are phases in, and we always come out of it. Always come out of it, we make it to the next phase. But for me, that's a low that I struggle with.
So what's been a big high point? Building a product for Hotstar or a good contract somewhere?
No, I think maybe at that point it was a high point, right? Mm-hmm. Getting a contract, winning a customer. But I think that kind of levels itself out because, you know, you can lose customers, the customer, you know, it just becomes business as usual. I think my high points are like Anand's continuous like ebbs and troughs is when the team meets, every last Thursday of the month, the four founders go out, right? And I look forward to that endlessly because otherwise we are all in different corners of this office fighting different fires and, you know, we're just like zoned out after a point. But then the four of us coming back together reminds us the great professional chemistry that we have. And, you know, we're able to sort of laugh about stuff, bitch about things, think about what's next, and just kind of clear the air every month. When our team comes together, like 3 times a week, we all meet. We can see the entire strength of 33 people together. That's a big high. I think that's on a regular basis, the highs that we grab and go. But I don't think we can actually we can't dwell on both the highs and the lows. We're just like, what's next?
Yeah, I'll give you two. One is, I remember we crossed a revenue milestone with a customer that we landed. And it was something that had been irritating us for a while, like hitting that milestone. And there's a milestone in dollar terms, which means it was a moving target, kept moving away from us because our costing is in rupees. But I still remember between the four of us, I fronted that commercial deal and I closed it and I put down the phone and I was about to call the three of you. And that second, because we then got on a video call and she had missed the call. So the other two said, why did you call? I said, I can't tell you. I had to wait for her to join. But it was a moment where we had finally like gone past it.
Do we have
good.
A picture of that?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, we took a screenshot where screenshot one is in tears, one is on his.
Oh, finally.
Finally. Yeah. It was a great high for us.
Yeah, that was a good one.
And the second one, it's not work related, is we once almost missed a flight. All four of us in Bombay.
Yeah.
And we got on it was a traffic jam and we got down and we sprinted to the terminal.
This is Vistara's flight. Bought ourselves premium economy tickets.
Yes, because it was the same price. It was also the same price as economy. And it was one of those examples of a challenge that we were destined to fail, but we refused to accept failure. We made it. We were the last ones. They had closed the door. And that's when we reached.
Those are the days when you had baggage, the security tags.
For cabin luggage.
For cabin luggage.
And there was a bowl which only had one. So we took all our laptops and shoved it into one bag. So the rest of us said, we don't have any cabin luggage. So we had to go and stop the plane.
Yeah, so we sent two ahead. And then the gate number was 83 or I don't know what the gate number was.
And I still remember we all got there sweaty, smelly. And there was a gentleman who was, you know, he was flaunting his premium economy boarding pass and he gave us a look. In my head, I was like, joke's on you. You got to sit next to us, man.
Yeah. It was good. Yeah. It was great fun. It was good times. And at before that, Jimmy, Jitin, we had gone to a bar, which is why we got in late to begin with, because we thought we'll catch a drink before we go. And he had brought a fresh t-shirt to wear so that he would be like neat and clean at the end of a day in Bombay and everything. And he was destroyed. He was destroyed by the time we reached. Yeah.
Okay, excellent conversation. So many more questions and I'm sure I'll be able to return to them. Kavita, Anand, thank you both for making time for me very generously once again. Definitely hope to keep the conversation going.
For sure. If you have any questions for us on ad tech, what's going on, please pick up the phone and talk to us, because there's definitely, you know, if you want to talk to other people in the industry and things like that, we're happy to partake. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Hari. It's been great.
That's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this. I'll be back in the new year with a new season of Startup Fridays. Until then, have a great Friday and a wonderful weekend. I'm Hari Arakli. Thank you for listening and a happy new year to you all.